When Charles Dickens wrote the book Tale of Two Cities, about the French Revolution and all the things that, many of the things that went on in those days, he began the book this way. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And that's what most people remember about the opening. Listen to the rest. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief. It was the epic of incredulity. It was the season of light, and it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, and it was the winter of despair. You think about history at any given time, and you might, depending on who you ask, get an answer something like that. Hey, what's today like? I think nowadays you ask people that kind of thing about the United States, and depending on who you ask, they'll say it's the best of times, or they'll say it's the worst of times. I just chose that introduction because I want to talk about a very high-level Old Testament idea. It's something over the years that I've begun to see and notice as I've studied the kings and the prophets and just the story of the Old Testament. And I want to call it the Tale of Two Thrones. I really believe that one of the things going on in the Old Testament scriptures is God was trying to present a picture that there were really two thrones that were in competition for power. One of them was the earthly throne of the earthly kings of Israel and Judah, and one was the heavenly throne of God. And actually, the earthly throne of the kings was often against God's rule and what God was trying to do. So God had to learn to rule in a different way. He didn't really rule through the kings themselves. My suggestion is he ruled through the prophets. I'll say more about that in a moment. But I believe it has a very practical application for us in our life, which I'll get to at the end of the lesson. It's also been on my mind because we're going to be studying the book of Jeremiah, and I think this helps us understand a little bit about what's happening in that book. Let's start in 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you would. And I want to show you where I believe all of this begins, where the competition between the throne of God and the throne on earth really begins to show itself. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, and that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them." Now, starting with this section, and most of you are familiar with this, God had been ruling the Jews as what some people call a theocracy, meaning he was the king of Israel. And what he kept doing was sending judges back in the book of Judges to deliver the people when they would get into trouble. Samuel was the last of those judges. He was also a prophet. And now you've got the people coming to Samuel and saying, "We don't want to be led like this anymore. We want a king like all the other nations, and we want a judge we can see sitting on a throne. We want to sort of be like everybody else." And Samuel's hurt by that. I believe God was too, and God tells Samuel, "Don't take it personal, they're rejecting me, not you. But I want you to tell them what's going to happen if they do this." Look now at verse 10. Here were the consequences that would come if they did indeed have a king. Verse 10 says, "So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. He said, 'This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to your servants. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Think about what's being said to them. The children of Israel already gave a tithe to the temple and to the priests. The temple wasn't built yet, but to the tabernacle. God was letting them have a lot of freedom. You know, they could dwell in their lands, they could grow their crops, they could do the things they wanted to do. And he says, if you guys have a king on earth, you're going to have extra taxes, your children are going to be hauled off to war, some of your land's going to disappear because the king's going to gobble it up. Everyone who's ever talked about government getting too big talks like this. Eventually the government owns more land than people, and eventually the government's taking more money than... And that was the warning they were given. Look at their reaction in verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, so that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go, every man, to his city. Those of you that are familiar with Bible history and the story after this point, just think about all the chaos and calamity and difficulty that came. Because of this one moment where the people said, we want a throne we can see. So I'm going to just put this up to think about this for just a minute. You know, the earthly throne of the kings started with Saul, then David and Solomon. Now, I made David's name bold there, or capital, because he's one of the few exceptions of a prophet and a king. Now, he could belong on the other side. Of all the people that understood what God was trying to do, it really was David that seemed to understand it the most. But beyond that, you have all these other kings in Judah and in Israel. There are all their names. How did that end in the Bible story? Well, like was predicted, the people cry out and say, we don't want this anymore. This isn't okay. God, please deliver us from these guys we picked to be our leaders. But ultimately, it ended up in destruction. The throne ceased to exist. We're going to read in the book of Jeremiah that we're looking at, that God's going to make a prediction in Jeremiah that there would never be another king sit on the throne in Jerusalem. That was going to be it once Babylonian captivity came. On the other hand, God still had work to do. God had a plan and a job for Israel to bring about the Messiah, and in many ways the kings were thwarting that or causing trouble with that. So throughout the Old Testament record, we have Samuel and Nathan and Ahijah and Shemaiah and people that aren't named, just called men of God or unnamed prophets, who keep showing up in the story speaking God's things and reminding everybody that God's ruling. And in fact, the work gets done because of them. And I just want you to give some thought to that as we consider why that's important. Go with me now to the New Testament. And I want you to think about why God would work like this. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. We're going to look at a few passages here and draw some lessons from it. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, starting around verse 18. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, But to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believed. For indeed, Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brethren, that there are not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are. So that no man may boast before God. But by his doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, so that just as it is written, let him who boasts, boasts in the Lord. The repeated theme in that section is that God has chosen the foolish things in the world to shame the wise. That God, I'm going to say it this way, God has often done things upside down. What everybody would think would be the way that something would be accomplished, or where power would reside, or where, you know, this is going to be the best idea for us as a people or a nation, God would just turn it upside down and do something completely different. Think about Old Testament history for just a minute. How many times did God do things like that? I mean, Israel itself didn't make any sense to pick as a nation to be the one to bless all the families of the earth. It was a slave nation within another nation that was powerful. I mean, for all practical purposes, why not choose Egypt instead of Israel? They were the powerhouse of the day. And then God even did stranger things with this strange little group of people. He puts them in the most desired land in all the region, the land of the Canaanites, where there's water and a great place to grow crops. And every nation throughout history has wanted that plot of land. And yet God doesn't make them a superpower when it comes to military might. Most of the time, they were just sort of a ragtag bunch of guys piecing things together, and God always protected them. How many times did God use barren women to bring children into the world? When he would make promises about the future, and these people would be standing there saying, we can't even have any kids, God. And then God would use a barren woman to bring a child. How many unlikely heroes are there in Scripture? You know, the little boy David against the giant, or the Esther who was in this kingdom of the Persians, and all of these people that were constantly the underdog. And yet every time, God would show that that's who he was ruling through and how he'd get his work done. I just want you to add the prophets to that list. The prophets weren't powerful in their day the same way the kings would have been. In fact, it was always kind of an enigma to the kings because the prophets would live in wilderness or in caves or like out in the middle of nowhere. And yet here they would always appear and they would be able to sort of get the message across that God wanted, and then God would protect them somehow until the time came where God allowed them to die. And then they would die at the hands of the kings. Look at verse 26. Look at verse 26. Here in 1 Corinthians 1. Listen to what Paul says. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. You know what I read there in that verse? Is that God's not done doing things upside down. Did you hear anybody when Trump was elected president? Did you hear anybody talk about that he was a Christian? Did you hear anybody say something like that? I read some things about that, and I heard some people talk about that, and there were some people I knew that were excited about that. I just want you to understand what I think is being said here. God's not going to get his work for the kingdom done through somebody like Donald Trump or through any other leader who's powerful and everybody thinks is something. God's going to always do his work through us. Now, we don't seem like much, but it's always how God's done it. We've got a part in this story. Go to 2 Corinthians now, chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4. I really like the way Paul talks about this in very practical terms, about how God gets his work done in ways that people think are foolish. Starting in verse 1 of 2 Corinthians 4. Therefore, since we have this ministry, as we received mercy, we do not lose heart. But we have renounced the things hidden because of shame, not walking in craftiness or adulterating the word of God, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving, so that they might not see the light of the gospel, light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus as Lord, and ourselves as your bondservants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Light shall shine out of darkness," is the one who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. And we can stop there, if you would, in the reading. What did that text teach? There are three things, I think. Number one, vision, or the ability to see what's really going on in the world, and things like light that will shine out of darkness, and things like faith. And I also put chapter 5, verse 7, if you look ahead to 5, 7, it says, "For we walk by faith and not by sight." You know, the foolish things that God's chosen to shame the wise were always sort of people that looked at the world differently. They understood that even though a time might be dark, look down there in verse 6, the best thing about dark times is that light can shine out of darkness. You know, the best thing about earthen vessels in verse 7 is that God can put a treasure in something like that. And this idea that people learn to walk by faith and not by sight is really what this is all about. Now, let's go back to the Old Testament, to 2 Kings 5. And I want to give you two illustrations of this. Two ways that we see God reigning and ruling on his throne through the prophets, but not through the kings, because these prophets had vision and faith, and they were different than everybody else. 2 Kings chapter 5. This story is a great story for a lot of reasons, but let's begin in verse 1 of chapter 5. Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram. The man was also a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went in and told his master, saying, Thus and thus spoke the little girl who's from the land of Israel. Then the king of Aram said, go, now I will send a letter to the king of Israel. He departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothes. Stop there if you would. Now the Bible describes Naaman as a great man, highly respected, a valiant warrior who was conquering lots of things. I don't know if you've ever met somebody who was really powerful like that. Maybe not that powerful. But somebody who just, everything they did was successful. You know what's interesting in this story? Is as powerful as this man is, he has absolutely no control over his sickness. Can't do anything about it. God's always chosen the foolish things to shame the wise. Something as foolish as a skin disease will bring somebody so high, so low, so easily. You know the other contrast here? The hero of this story is a little girl. Just some little girl who gets taken captive. And instead of being bitter and angry about her captivity, she actually cares about her master and mentions to his wife, I wish my master was back in Israel because there's a prophet there who could heal him of his leprosy. Time out for a second. In Luke chapter 4 in the New Testament, when Jesus was in the synagogue of his hometown, do you remember that time where they wanted to throw him off a cliff and kill him? He told 2 stories that day that made them angry. One of the stories he told was about Elisha and Naaman. And the comment Jesus made in Luke 4 was that there were many lepers in Israel in those days, but Elisha healed none of them, only Naaman the Syrian. You know why I think that's an important piece to this story? This little girl had never even seen Elisha do it. She'd never witnessed it. She'd never even heard about him doing it. According to Jesus, he'd never done it in Israel. But that little girl knew he could. She believed it. And she suggested it. Now, I don't know why Naaman was humble enough to go to the king. Maybe it was his only last hope, because he couldn't figure out any other way to be healed. But he goes off to Israel carrying money and a letter to the king. Let's read now verse 6. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, and now as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy. When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? But consider now and see how he is seeking a quarrel against me. By the way, I think this is one of the more humorous stories in the Bible, where Naaman shows up to the king, gives him a letter, and the letter says, here's my warrior, heal him of his leprosy. And the king, you know, loses his mind. You know, he starts tearing his clothes and he's like, who do these people think I am? I'm not God. I can't do this. They just want to pick a fight with me. Now, if there's ever an illustration that the kings on earth didn't understand the throne of heaven, this is the story. But there was a prophet. And I like that the little girl hadn't said, go to the king. She said, go to the prophet, right? Verse 8. It happened when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent word to the king, saying, why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. By the way, I think that's loaded, that statement. You send that warrior to me, and then he'll know there's a prophet, even though you, king, seem to not realize it, and you didn't think to send him to me. He's going to know that there is a prophet. Verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be clean. But Naaman was furious and went away and said, behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not the Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Elisha won't even come out. Elisha sends a servant out, which I think Naaman found disrespectful. But he tells him to do something that was not in Naaman's mind. In fact, I've always liked the way Naaman says this. He says, "Behold, I thought." The guy who trained me to preach, Barry Kircheville, he was around an older preacher when he was young. And this older preacher, they would talk about things, and he'd give him some sort of instruction about preaching. And often Barry would start a sentence, "Well, I thought..." And as soon as Barry would start a sentence with, "Well, I thought," this older preacher would say, "Behold, I thought." And he would like quote Elisha or Naaman the leper. And he would say, "Stop thinking." How many people have done this with God? I thought it'd be better to have a king. I thought that our nation was going to be saved because of some political, like, you know, group or somebody who was elected. Or I thought that God would have me do this to be saved. Or I thought that this would be the right thing. Maybe it is servants who understand things best. Look at verse 13. Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, had the prophet told you to do something, some great thing, would you have not done it? How much more then when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. What a reasonable servant. His servant comes and he says, "Look, Naaman, had he told you to go out and conquer a nation, you would have done it. All he told you to do was go dip. Can't you be humble enough to just do that?" And Naaman softens again and goes and does what God said. And it's exactly as God promised. Again, God was getting his work done. But he wasn't getting his work done by the powerful throne on earth, but the far more powerful throne of the strange fellows who lived in the wilderness. Go to chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 8 of 2 Kings. Now the king of Aram was warring against Israel, and he counseled with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Arameans are coming down there." The king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, so that he guarded himself there more than once or twice. Now the heart of the king of Aram was enraged over this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, "Will you tell me which of us is for the king of Israel?" One of his servants said, "No, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." So he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and take him." And it was told him, saying, "Behold, he is in Dothan." He sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. Stop there if you would. I like this story too. It's the Syrians again. I mean, in the chapter before, the great warrior of Syria was healed of leprosy, but for whatever reason, the king of Aram still wants to fight against Israel. Well, every time he plans something, Elisha goes and tells the king of Israel and says, "Hey, don't go there, they're setting a trap for you." And every time the Syrian king, like, is thwarted, he thinks there's a spy or, like, you know, a rat in his office. So he gathers all the guys together and he says, "Who's telling my secrets?" And they said, "Well, king, don't you remember that guy that healed Naaman? He's pretty powerful and he knows everything you're talking about, even in your bedroom. He's the guy that's ruining everything." But it really wasn't Elisha, was it? It was God. And God wasn't talking to the king of Israel directly. God wasn't giving him the understanding. Now, this king of Aram surrounds the city where Elisha is. Let's read now verse 15. "Now when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and gone out, chariots and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" So he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When they came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Strike this people with blindness, I pray." So he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he brought them to Samaria. This servant of Elisha wakes up and sees the army surrounding and he panics and he wakes up Elisha and he says, "What are we going to do?" Now this statement, "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." What a strange thing to say. You know, the last lesson of this is that God has always ruled and worked through people who had spiritual vision, like people who could see the world in a very different way. They knew that what was going on in the White House or in Jerusalem or in Samaria wasn't really what was going on in the world. What was going on in the world was whatever God wanted to accomplish. And they could see it. And they knew it. And they trusted it. And because of that, he could say, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." Personally, I think Christians are too afraid these days. I know from time to time I get that way. But I want us all to remember that God's on the throne. That God's always chosen sort of the invisible things. You know, the things that only people by faith can see. And he's always asked us to trust in that, not in anything. Not anything that we could see on earth. And I believe the story of the Old Testament is there for a reason. We studied a proverb a couple weeks ago that I'd like for us to finish with. Look at Proverbs 29. Proverbs 29. Verse 18. "Where there is no vision, the people are unrestrained, but happy is he who keeps the law." Where there is no vision. When people don't know what God said or what God does or how God rules or how God reigns or how powerful God is, when people don't see spiritually the things that need to be seen, look at the rest of the verse. They're unrestrained. Christians, we need to learn to show restraint. In all the panic and all the fear and all the fighting that goes on, restraint, peacemaking, calmness of spirit comes because you have vision. Because you know what God said. I heard a story one time. It's such a simple story, but for whatever reason, it stuck with me for decades now. And I think it illustrates this, maybe not in the grandest of ways, but in the most practical of ways. There was a woman who lost her husband. And she was young, and her husband was young, and she had a little girl. And it just upended the woman. Like, it just wrecked her. Every day, she would cry and cry. She would lock herself in her room. She would mope around the house. She just couldn't figure out how to go forward. And her little girl, when she was 7 years old one day, looked into her mother's tear-filled eyes and said, "Mom, did God die?" And the mother hugged the little girl. And she said, "You're right, sweetheart, God didn't die. And you're his messenger. And you've reminded me." And things were different from that day on. And it just took somebody to remember that no matter how dark days seem, no matter what it is that's going on. God rules and reigns and is very much alive. I hope that lesson will be helpful to you. We're going to offer an invitation. And in fact, I didn't ask him to pick this invitation song, but look at the first line. Zion's call sweetly rings over land and sea, bidding us look to realms above. So in every way that we live on earth, there is a Zion that we belong to, a kingdom that is higher, but we have to think about things above. Let's stand and sing, and if you can answer the invitation, let us know. We can help you.